Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most people go to Biltmore House to submerge themselves in a bygone era. They go there for the same reason people watched Belmont Abbey, to see how the other half lived in the Gilded Age. But of course, like today, George W. Vanderbilt, who built Biltmore House, wasn't part of the other half. He was part of the 0.1%. His inheritance was throwing off about $500,000 in gains every year back in 1888, and he wanted to join his rich friends in building a getaway outside New York City. His friends were focused on Newport, Rhode Island, but Vanderbilt went south to Asheville to build what came to be America's largest house. All 170, nearly 79,000 square feet of it. But the story of Biltmore House doesn't just center on the Vanderbilts or even on the home itself, but on what the family and the house have done for Asheville. All these stories are told in Denise Kiernan's new book, The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. And Denise Kiernan joins us to share some of these stories this hour. Welcome back to the program.
Hello, it's great to be back.
You are the author, of course, of The Girls of Atomic City, which was on the New York Times bestseller list, and I understand that this book, The Last Castle, went on that list almost before the ink was dry.
It was. I'm beyond thrilled. Yes, in its first week of eligibility, it made it onto both the hardcover list and the combined ebook and print list. So
Wow.
I'm delighted. You know, really, really happy.
I mentioned Belmont Abbey. I mentioned Downton Abbey.
That's the sequel, Mike. Belmont Abbey. The sequel.
I mentioned Downton Abbey in connection with Biltmore House a second ago, because we're talking about the same time period, the same excesses, the same grandiosity, the same concern actually for the land. The Crawleys had a great concern for the land, and so did the Vanderbilts. Evidently, the only thing missing is the accent. Do you think that is an accurate comparison?
Downton Abbey starts a little bit later than my
right.
book. My book does start back in 1888 when George Vanderbilt first became interested in building his country home here in Asheville. And Downton Abbey, I believe, if I remember correctly, really starts with the sinking of the Titanic.
It does.
But they do cover, very a very similar feel, very similar setting. The idea of, a family's country house and the surrounding village, much concern for land and farming, and I think in both the fictional Downton Abbey and the very real story behind Biltmore House, just watching these families grapple with very serious change. Economic change, here in America, the end of the Gilded Age, the dawn of the Progressive Era. It is definitely very fun to make those comparisons. And then, of course, you go toward the end of Downton Abbey and you have them opening their house to outsiders, which is also, of course, something that eventually the Vanderbilt family ended
right.
up doing with their house.
I kept thinking, because you're right, they filmed a lot of Downton Abbey at whatever that house is in England, where
Highclere Castle.
Highclere Castle,
which, by the way, is smaller than Biltmore House.
Yes, and I kept thinking somebody needs to do a television show and base it at Biltmore House. I mean, a series.
I'm sorry, could you say that again, Mike? Maybe several times, just in case someone listening involved in film and television missed it. I think we could call it Appalachian Abbey. Downton Appy. I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of ways we could go with this.
You know, the Downton Abbey story does begin with the sinking of the Titanic, and you've done a lot of research. You did a lot of research for this book, and a lot of the research came from reading voluminous numbers of letters to and from the Biltmores, or the Vanderbilts, rather. And one of those letters was about the Titanic that no one had ever mentioned before, I'm told.
I had never seen it mentioned ever before. It was actually a great deal of my research was done in the Manuscripts and Archives Division of the New York Public Library. Two of George Vanderbilt's very, very dear friends, William B. Osgood Field and Paul Lester Ford, novelist, they had their papers at the New York Public Library, as did some of their family members. And actually, there was a very interesting letter that went from Edith Vanderbilt to Paul Lester Ford's sister, describing their decision not to sail on the Titanic. Mm. And it was the first time I had ever come across Edith or George actually talking about why they had not sailed on the Titanic. There were other letters in the family talking about who had sailed on the Titanic. There was concern from some of George and Edith's relatives that they were actually on the sinking ship. But this was the first time I actually saw in Edith's hand, you know, that kind of commentary directly on their decision not to sail. Mm. And it's always so interesting to, you know, to look at those letters and hold those letters and feel the stationery and see the ink. And it always gets me thinking about, you know, what is research going to be like? You know, now they're basically, you know, reviewing people's hard drives, and scrolling through email just doesn't feel like it has the same kind of charm, you know?
Even if people, you know, keep those emails. I'm mercilessly delete emails because once I've read them and acted on them, why keep them around? I don't need to archive my correspondence. But people, I suppose, do that, but it's not the same. And I'm curious.
It is not. And you get these, you know, you have you. There's nothing like opening up a folder in the New York Public Library and just like having the dust waft up your nose, you know, and seeing the stamps, you know, the actual stamps on the outsides of the envelopes and stationery from hotels that no longer exist. And there's so much richness there that. Well, we'll see.
I'm curious why, and maybe you don't know the answer to this. I've talked a lot with historians who use letters as primary source material, and they bemoan the fact that we're moving away from written communication into this electronic world, which will not leave us very much for future historians. But I'm wondering why people of that day kept their correspondence. Why would you keep it? And it's one thing to donate it to the New York Public Library after you know those letters are going to be valuable for some reason, but why would you keep it?
You know, that's a great question. But, you know, so much of that life, when I would look through some of these papers, you know, you also have people's diaries and you have their, they kept records of visitation, which I found fascinating. You literally, or dinner books, you know, an entire book that was just dinners they had attended and what was served and who sat where. Mm. But the visitation books as well, you know, you would go by someone's house if, you know, they were there, you would perhaps visit with them, you would leave a card if they weren't. And in one of George's nieces in her letters, there were a couple entries where she was just trying to get by to visit with someone. And this person was either never at home or never accepting her. And at a certain point in her book, she wrote, not I give up, but it was some sort of like, you know, late 19th century version of I give up, you know, I'm never going to get, you know, be received by this person. So there was this kind of fascination with documenting, I think, everything that went on. And I really don't know why, but I'm glad they did.
So the idea of taking a picture of the food you're eating and putting it on Instagram is not a new idea. It's just a new technology, just a new way of
doing it. That is a very good way to do it. The volume that we have, though, is quite astounding. But yes, now you make me feel better for all those lame cheeseburger pictures I have. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I feel better about that.
You wrote with your husband, Joe, about our founding fathers. You were on the program to talk about that years ago. Mm-hmm. You wrote a New York Times bestseller that I've already talked about a little bit called The Girls of Atomic City, about the women who worked on the Manhattan Project. Now this, the Founding Fathers book seems like a layup because everybody's interested in those people and that time in our history. Not many people, I don't think, knew all that much about the women who worked on the atomic bomb. And outside of North Carolina, do people know much about Biltmore House and its connection to the Vanderbilts?
You know, that's a great question. I am a st- astounded at the people who have no idea. And I've been interviewed by people who had no idea what the house was. Usually when I like to play a little game and, you know, ask people, you know, what's the largest private house in America? And almost everyone mentions San Simeon.
Which is the Hearst
a Hearst castle out mm-hmm. in San Simeon, which is, I believe, around 66,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just a fraction of Biltmore House. And in fact, when I... You know, it was the same when I was researching, when I was researching Girls of Atomic City in Oak Ridge is, you know, a lot of the folks in Oak Ridge thought, are you sure you want to write about this? Everybody knows this story. And I kept telling them, trust me, not everybody knows this story. And so sometimes I do think when we're very close to something, it's easy to forget that there are people that don't know anything about it. And I remember, did you see the documentary, The Queen of Versailles?
No.
Did you happen to see that?
No.
Okay, so... Years ago, when I was wrapping up Girls of Atomic City and thinking about what to do next, I remember seeing this documentary. It's about a Florida, modern day, it's about a Florida real estate developer who announces very publicly and very repeatedly that he is going to build the largest house in America outside of Orlando. And they document his attempt to do this. It was never finished, by the way. If it had been finished, it was going to be 90,000 square feet. So even if it had been finished, it would have been about half the size of Biltmore House. And yet this gets picked up by international newspapers, media across the country, and no one said, by the way, this wouldn't be the biggest house in America. And I thought, you know, there is something here. And I'm amazed at the people who don't know about it. But on the other hand, there's so many things that we all think we should know, or we think everybody should know, that we don't. But, you know, similar to what you asked actually got me thinking that, you know, similar to Girls of Atomic City, Girls of Atomic City is really not just about Oak Ridge. It's really just Oak Ridge is kind of a tiny lens through which to examine a much larger American issue, which is the dawn of the nuclear age. And similarly, I feel like The Last Castle uses Biltmore House and the people who lived there as a tiny lens through which to examine really the American experience at the turn of the 20th century.
Well, that's what you've done in all three of these books, then, in a way. You've looked at people involved in new beginnings, in change.
Yes, exactly. It's thank you. I will use that going forward. That actually makes a lot of sense. You're making sense of me, Mike. it really is. I find as a reader that I like to read stories where I feel as though I can relate on some level to what I'm reading about. So, you know, with the founders, one of the things that inspired my husband Joe and I to write about all 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence was that we usually in America talk about five of them,
right,
you know, over and over and over again. But there were 56 guys who were involved in this very significant event. You know, who were they? And some of them were very average folks. To my mind, relatable people who were going through an extreme moment of change. And again, you know, Girls of Atomic City, it's a little challenging for me, and I think most people, to relate to Nobel Prize winning physicists in the desert in New Mexico. And usually when you talk about the Manhattan Project, you talk about the gang at Los Alamos, which is fascinating. But, you know, I can relate to a bunch of, 17-year-old, folks heading off to live in dorms and work together.
And perhaps that is why you begin the book with Edith Dresser, who ends up being Edith Vanderbilt. We'll talk about that when we come back. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Denise Kiernan is our guest. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Last Castle, which is about the Biltmore House and the people surrounding it and the impact of those people and the house on Asheville, North Carolina. And we were talking about how you were interested when you wrote about the Founding Fathers in the people we don't ever hear about, the of the 56, you mentioned that there were five that we hear all the time about.
Sure.
Is that why you begin this book, which you would think would be focused on George W. Vanderbilt, whose idea it was to build this house, and in fact did build this house, but you begin it with Edith Dresser, who ends up becoming Mrs. Vanderbilt. Is that why you began with her? Because she was not rich.
That's right. That's part, definitely part of the reason. As a writer and as a looking at Edith as a character and as a woman, I mean, I definitely wanted to establish Edith Dresser as an individual, as a young woman, as a young unmarried woman, before she simply becomes, you know, the mistress of Biltmore and becomes, you know, the wife and steps into her husband's world, because she was so fascinating. And, you know, she was a direct descendant of Peter Stuyvesant. Her name was Edith Stuyvesant Dresser. Peter Stuyvesant was the last Dutch governor of New York. So, I mean, her family claimed an extreme, you know, American lineage, about as American as you could get at that point, and was a very highly respected family within social circles. But she did not have the same kind of financial resources that George Vanderbilt did. And watching her grow as an individual from a young girl into a young woman, and see some of the challenges that she and her sisters and brother faced growing up, also allowed me to really explore what life was like in the late 20th century. Her sister's papers at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, were a tremendous resource here and had such wonderful, vivid descriptions of what their young lives were like.
Late 19th century.
Late 19th. Yes. Did I say 20th?
You did, yeah.
I did, well, yes, at least I didn't say 21st. Late 19th century. And it just allowed me to really, to help readers, yeah, you know, sink into that world. Because as a writer, you know, we talk about world building, and you often hear writers talk about this when you talk about fiction or, you know, science fiction or fantasy, you know, in the sense that you need to sort of buy into what Middle Earth is if you're going to, you know, run off with Sam and Frodo and understand their journey. Well, and we do the same thing in nonfiction, but we use people's letters and descriptions in towns and newspaper articles and things of that nature. So it was interesting to me, starting with Edith, right at the same time that George was traveling down to Asheville with his mother and falling in love with the area, to show how those lives would intersect constantly. It almost seemed kind of fated to me that they would run into each other.
Yeah, you talk about that, how not just the two of them, but lots of people in their circle, I think you call them the 400.
The 400, yeah.
Their lives kept touching each other, bouncing off each other. But would that, in such rarefied air, would that be, mm-hmm, is that unusual?
I mean,
the Trumps don't hang out with just anybody, you know?
Yeah, I don't think it's unusual. One of the things that I found interesting about that aspect of the book, looking at, you know, today we talk about the, you know, the 1%, and then you talked about the 400, which was a number based supposedly on the number of people that Mrs. Astor could comfortably fit in her ballroom on Fifth Avenue. So if you made the ballroom cut, you know, you were definitely in with the right crowd. And, you know, that aspect of watching, because these people were stalked by, you know, what were the celebrity media, celebrity journalists of the time, much the same way, you know, the celebrities are followed today by, you know, TMZ or various magazines. Mm. And so while it may not have been unusual for that world to seem very claustrophobic, You know, it was, to me, it provided a very interesting parallel in a sense with our modern day life and, you know, people who seem to always be on the same society pages together, at the same theater premieres, all of those sorts of things.
So I want to race through because we're going to run out of time. This is a very in-depth book here on these
yes,
people
yeah.
and that place. So let's race through some history
yes.
here.
George
Washington Vanderbilt came late to marriage. As you mentioned, he was touring this Asheville with his mother, who went down there for, I guess, medicinal purposes to take the air.
It was not unusual for folks to come to Western North Carolina. Mm-hmm. They thought the mountain air was curative for
yeah.
symptoms of like tuberculosis and malaria. So they sat on breathing porches.
So
to breathe.
He came late to marriage for the time. Today it wouldn't be that unusual, but he was 34 years old when he decided to marry. He was a confirmed bachelor in most people's eyes, but his mm-hmm. but his mother died in 1896. He had already built Biltmore House. Is that what moved him to marry Edith at that time? Simply he's rambling around on 179,000 square feet?
Well, you know, it was in danger of becoming the largest bachelor pad ever.
Yes.
I mean, this takes the idea of a man cave to a whole other level. So he was certainly had some pressure from his older sisters. I don't know if that's what drove him to marry Edith. In fact,
weren't they paired up like on a blind
on
date?
On a ship. Yeah, on a blind date on a transatlantic ship.
Oh boy.
As one did. The wonderful letters and diaries of his friend, William Osgood Field, who was sort of like pressed into service, by George's sisters to say, get these two together. Even on that trip, there's a wonderful description of them sitting in a hotel room and George talking about how he wanted to do all of these things first, you know, mm-hmm. before he got married. And, then wanted to marry a woman who was about 10 years younger than he was. And you think to yourself, well, gosh, how much else do you really need to do, George? And then off they went to India and traveled around there and then, you know, came back to Paris. And he had already met Edith at this point, and I think they definitely hit it off. And she was coincidentally about 10 years younger than he was.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe he was telegraphing his intent the entire time.
So George was the grandson of Cornelius Vanderbilt.
That's right.
Nicknamed the Commodore. Why?
Mm-hmm. Cornelius, who's fascinating and really started out, well, he's the founder of the Vanderbilt family fortune,
right.
Started out just a very scrappy guy without much, who built a tremendous shipping and rail empire, hence the nickname the Commodore, and which apparently started out when he was a kid as kind of a silly nickname because he really started with, you know, one little ferry, going back and forth from his home on Staten Island to the island of Manhattan, and then just literally and figuratively blew everybody else out of the water with his acumen and his business dealings, often ruthless but seemingly efficient. His son William Henry was George's father, and Cornelius left the bulk of his fortune to William Henry, and William Henry more than doubled it very quickly. So this was, George was the youngest son of somebody who was likely one of the richest men in the world.
He got the least amount of money in terms of inheritance. He was the poorest Vanderbilt, I believe.
Yes, poor thing.
Yes.
Yes, he was really scraping by.
Well, George's brothers continued running the company after the father mm-hmm. handed it over, but George never had to work. Why? Why did he not run the company with his brothers?
You know, his oldest brother, Cornelius II, mm-hmm. Sort of became the patriarch of the family after William Henry, George's father, passed away. And George's brothers and even some of his brothers-in-law worked in the family business. George was considerably, younger than his oldest brother and very close with his parents, remained very close with his mother after his father died and lived in the family house at 640 Fifth Avenue after his father died. And he just, from a very young age, was just fascinated. Frankly, he lives how I would live if I didn't have to work for money. He read a ton of books and kept very good track of what he read. He went to the opera. He went to the theater. He went to concerts. He traveled extensively. He was involved in a lot of charitable activities. And I think he just, was a patron of the arts. His father, William Henry, had an amazing art collection that resided at 640 Fifth Avenue. And so that was just, you know, how George grew up, and the business world held little appeal.
But he inherited, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, because all these numbers rolling around in my head, I sometimes get confused.
Oh my God, tell me about it, me too.
I think he inherited around $5 million, which doesn't sound like a lot of money today, but back then it was enormous.
It was actually more than that. If you take into consideration, he had gotten money from his grandfather when he died. He'd gotten money from his father when he died. When he was starting to build Biltmore, he had access to around $12 million.
Okay. And that
so
was throwing
it was a little
off,
more than that.
That was throwing off about $500,000 a year in cash in 1888. So he had to do something with all this money, and it was the fashion of the period for people of that wealth range to build summer cottages in places like Newport, Rhode Island. And he chose to go south, and he built this 179,000 square foot home, 178,926 square feet to be exact, designed by Richard Morris Hunt, who designed the Metropolitan Museum in New York. It has 250 rooms, 10,000 books, because he was a voracious reader. He read 81 books a year, I understand.
With 10,000 in that library, yes. I think there are many more that did not fit in that library.
The dining room table there seats 64. The house houses priceless works of arts. The ground and gardens were designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park in New York. But still, that's a big house. $12 million. you couldn't build that house for anything approaching $12 million today. How did he have the funds to do it?
That's an excellent question. It is very difficult. I was not able to nail down the exact expenditure of what went into the house when it was built. And there are conflicting reports of how much he actually spent on the house. He certainly ran into financial difficulties down the line.
Well, it's true, isn't it, that he didn't intend for it to be 179,000 square foot. His architect just let it get away from him.
You know, I think they all just, it's one of the greatest mysteries to my mind of Biltmore, how they got so carried away. Because there was actually an early sketch done by Richard Morris Hunt, and it was titled something along the lines of Mr. Vanderbilt's Old Colonial House, you know, and it was around 13,000 square feet. I want to say I might be a little off on that, but significantly smaller. When I was looking at Richard Morris Hunt's writings and some of his correspondence with his wife, Catherine Hunt, one of the more interesting things that, you know, he would say was he was concerned about scale, you know, and he sort of wanted the house to be appropriately scaled for the setting. Well, you know, they're in the Blue Ridge, we're in the Blue Ridge Mountains. So, you know, when you talk about scale, it's, what are you talking about, really? But, you know, Richard Morris Hunt was, you know, hands down the most renowned Gilded Age architect. If you wanted a fancy house, that's who you went to. Frederick Law Olmsted. I mean, I cannot imagine a better dream team any point in history if you wanted to have a country house than Richard Morris Hunt handling the architecture and Frederick Law Olmsted handling the landscape architecture. And George was such an admirer, especially of Hunt's. And Hunt had worked with the family, had worked with his brothers. George had worked with Hunt on the family's mausoleum on Staten Island. They developed a very close, almost father-son kind of relationship. And to me, it was, you talk about, we all talk about project creep. If you've ever had like, you know, a bathroom redone in your house, you know, when you think, oh, all I really need to do is, you know, change out the tile. And the next thing you know, you're swapping out the bathtub and you're, so to me, this was like project creep on just an unbelievable level. Yeah.
Yeah. But this house, anybody who goes to Biltmore, it learns very quickly through the docents how innovative this house was for the time. We have to remember this is 1896 when it was done? Something like that?
Opened, the official, in quotes, family and friends opening was Christmas of 1895.
Okay, so this house had refrigeration that kept food at 40 degrees. It had an elevator. It had washing machines. Nobody had washing machines. It had
drying racks, yeah.
70,000 gallon indoor swimming pool, AC and DC current. I'm curious as to why it needed both. Steam heat throughout. I think they burnt through, in 1 week at one point, they burnt through 25 tons of coal heating the place. I mean, would anybody else of that wealth have had these features in their home in 1896?
Well, one of the things, and they had internal heating.
Yes.
Of course, the Romans had internal heating, but then everybody kind of got away from it. The Romans had everything, and everybody kind of got away from it. But it was not unusual for some English country houses to have internal heating. Hmm. But what you're bringing up is one of the things that I find most fascinating about the house is that it kind of straddles two worlds. I mean, from the exterior, you look at it and it's reminiscent of these, you know, old European chateaus and estates, especially in the Loire Valley of France, where Hunt and George had actually gone to get some architectural inspiration. So, you know, on the surface, it kind of harkens back to a much older time, but it was so incredibly technologically advanced. So it's as though it really did live in two different worlds. And you talked about the AC and the DC. Well, this was around the time when that debate was still raging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when, you know, was AC going to win out or was DC going to win out? So, you know, George and Hunt were like, oh, let's put in both. You know, why not? And you had these tremendous boilers that would heat, you know, could heat around 20,000 gallons of water, the steam from which wafted up this essentially a radiator system and allowed natural convection to push warm air into the rooms on the upper floors of the house. But I mean, this was a time when most people didn't have indoor plumbing,
yeah.
You know, and they're taking it to this extent.
Most of the impact of the house, though, is what happened around the house, and we'll talk about that when we get back with Denise Kiernan, author of The Last Castle, in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Denise Kiernan is back with us again after having written several other books. She's written The Last Castle, which is about the Biltmore House, but it's also about the people involved in building and living in the Biltmore House, who they entertained, who their friends were, what they ate, and what impact all of this had on Asheville, North Carolina. It's middle 1800s. Nobody knows where Asheville is. Certainly people in New York didn't know where Asheville was. How did his mother discover Asheville?
Well, you know, it was not terribly unusual for moneyed families up and down the East Coast to travel to the mountains of Western North Carolina.
Okay.
Charlestonians would often come to this part of the state in order to escape the summer heat. And what happened was a very interesting medical community sprang up here because the mountain air developed this reputation for being able to, you know, cure or relieve the symptoms resulting from things like tuberculosis and malaria. So people would, a number of very well-known doctors, you know, set up shop in and around here, and people would travel here to breathe the air. And the term breathing porches arose, which is one of my favorite things in the world. And so you would have people come down here and be treated by doctors, and then in their spare, you know, convalescing time would breathe on a porch. And they would come down here to do that. And George's mother was actually treated by a doctor, Samuel Westray Battle, here in Asheville. So that was one of the motivating factors that brought the pair down here in 1888. And, you know, while his mom was being treated and breathing on a porch, mm-hmm. George would hop on a horse and, you know, ride around, take in the scenery, and just really fell in love with some of the vistas here.
I should mention that you keep saying here because you are actually in Asheville.
Yes.
And you're speaking to us from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio. It took 6 years and 1,000 people to build this house. He had to construct a railway line to get materials from Asheville to where the house is. And if anybody's been there, you know it takes a long time to get from Asheville to the house because he wanted it to be surprising as you came upon the house. He wanted it to explode into your vision. And he's
that was part of Olmsted's vision.
Yes, it was accomplished. But the 1,000 people must have injected a great deal of money initially into the economy of Asheville. Because it was not just ordinary laborers, although there were many of those. It was stonesmiths and woodsmiths and people who knew how to carve.
There were a tremendous number of people who were brought down from points north, materials brought in from places like Indiana. And you had all of these folks descending on the area. And basically, initially, what we now know as Biltmore Village, beyond the gates of what mm-hmm. is now seen as Biltmore Estate, that was initially temporary wooden housing for so many of these people who were coming down there. And that little train junction there was at one point known as Best, B-E-S-T, before, you know, it became part of George's Holdings and he renamed everything Biltmore. So, yes, I mean, there were houses were built when the temporary housing was replaced by the lovely stucco pebble dash structures we're familiar with now. If anybody comes to visit Biltmore Village in Asheville, those went up afterwards, and there were shops and there were schools, and it was a huge influx in that area south of Asheville.
This house was built in the middle of the wilderness, essentially, and Frederick Law Olmsted, who did Central Park, designed the grounds, and I'm told that when he first arrived, he wasn't terribly impressed, but he turned it into something spectacular. Everybody who goes there in the spring for the flowers, etc., raves about how gorgeous all of this is. But what really is part of this is the natural beauty of the place. Mm-hmm. How much of that is due, and the preservation of that is due to the Vanderbilts, but particularly to Edith?
I have often thought it was, it's very interesting that when you talk about Biltmore and its impact on Asheville, so much of the focus is the house, and rightly so. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But to my mind, one of the greatest impacts that the family had was not what was built, but what wasn't built, what was actually left untouched. So, you know, George basically started buying up these various plots of land initially through the names of agents, trying to keep his name out of it. When he was about 2,000 acres in, he brought down Olmsted and said, you know, take a look. What do you think? Am I making a huge mistake? And, you know, Olmsted saw land that had been terribly, terribly overforested because back then nobody thought we would ever run out of trees. The idea that we could ever run out of trees was ridiculous. So part of the challenge beyond the beautiful gardens and everything surrounding the house itself was trying to get the forest back on its feet, because at the height of his holdings, you know, George had somewhere between 120 and 125,000 acres. So two foresters were brought in. The first one was Gifford Pinchot, and after that was German forester Carl Schenck. And Schenck and George, I mean, their goal was to implement what was known then as scientific forestry, which simply meant rejuvenating, rebuilding, restoring the health of a forest while simultaneously lumbering it. And this was common in Europe, but not common here. So to teach American foresters, or you know, people who worked in the forests, how this operated, Georgian Schenck started the first ever school of forestry in the United States of America, the Biltmore Forestry
and
School.
And one of them
the
went
first,
on
first ever in the United States.
One of them went on to be the first director of the Forest Service.
Gifford Pinchot did, in fact. Yeah, the first forester, Gifford Pinchot, presented his Biltmore Forest Plan at the 1893 World Expo in Chicago, where Hunt and Olmsted also played key roles, and had just had a tremendous career and became the first chief of the new U.S. Forest Service. I live here in Asheville now, and you know, people come here to paddle the rivers, to climb, to drive the Blue Ridge Parkway, to watch the leaves change. And about a good, just shy of 90,000 of those, 125,000 acres became the basis for Pisgah National Forest. And, you know, I think you could make the argument that if such an effort had not been made to restore the forests, which started, you know, back in the late 19th century, and to keep those holdings together, I don't think Asheville would be the same destination city it is today.
And keeping that land together had a lot to do with Edith Vanderbilt, who inherited the estate after her husband died at a very young age. I think he died at, 51 or something like that?
Very, very young.
They didn't live together very long, 14 years, I think, something like that. But the just as happened in Downton Abbey, times were changing. They fell on estate fell on hard times. I believe the Great Depression played a big role in that, too. But she somehow donated the land or got money for the land from the government because it became the Pisgah National Forest. She could just as easily have sold it off to industrialists and developers, and it could be, you know, townhomes now.
And that could have happened actually at any point during during George's life as well. He was looking to sell a large chunk of his holdings to the government even before he died. It was clear that he wanted to keep that track together because he wanted to go. He had just tons of books on on horticulture and forestry, and that area meant, you know, so much to them. Keeping it together was you could say that they saved the forest with their efforts to rejuvenate it. And then in the end, when, you know, Edith was able to sell that chunk of land to the United States, the forest saved them. You could sort of see that that switch happened. But I think the forestry aspect of Biltmore House and Biltmore Estate, I think, is one of the largest impacts to this day on this area.
And she was also very heavily involved in charity work, but unlike others of her time, she actually got her hands dirty. She actually went out and did deliveries of things and participated, and she created careers. How so?
I just love her. She, she was constantly involved on a very intimate personal level with what was going on in the village, the lives of the employees, the lives of their spouses. There were some missionaries who came down from Chicago, and they were carvers, ceramicists, fabric workers, and they would, you know, carve in their little shop in Biltmore Village, and they had sort of this ad hoc kind of school going on where they would train some of the children who were curious about what they were doing. And Edith gets wind of this, as does the Reverend at All Souls. And they give money to this. And eventually, this turns into eventually Biltmore Estate Industries and is training individuals to make fabric, to carve. And these, you know, because of her constant attention to this enterprise and her ability to get some of her more well-heeled friends to wear some of these fabrics that were made by these kids, essentially, you know, in Biltmore Village, and get these carvings into the hands of, I mean, even a senator on Fifth Avenue in New York City, she just was able to not only grow this industries, but just had a school, a function there for folks to reconnect with, you know, what were long established Appalachian arts and crafts traditions, and use those traditions in order to make a living. And yeah, she was so hands-on, just which I find impressive in this day and age. And when you consider that, you know, the mistress of the largest house in America was just so personally involved with these people's lives, I find it just really, really quite moving.
How long was the heyday of the house itself in terms of the family's use of the house? How long did that period last? It couldn't have been very long.
You know, it. He opened with family and friends around Christmas of 1895. Based on travels I was able to decipher by going through various ship registers and letters and newspaper articles and things of that nature, they seemed to start spending more time away around, I would say, around 1908, 1909. The house was always still very much in their life, and they did spend time here, but also, as Cornelia got older, she was born in 1900, and as she got older and was, you know, going to need high school, they were starting to take her schooling more into account. She ended up going to a place called Miss Madeira's School, which actually still exists in Washington, D.C., and they had rented a home there and eventually bought a home there. And it seems to be a good solid 10 years. And they traveled within that time. I mean, that's what you did. You know, so why not take off to Paris for, you know, a
visitors,
few months if you can.
Yeah, visitors today kind of marvel at the house and its size and the innovations that it had available to it for its time. But evidently, visitors to the house in the time of its heyday, people who invited there by the Vanderbilts themselves, sometimes found it less than ideal, shall we say. Somebody complained about never being able to find a bathroom.
Henry James.
Yes.
And the author, noted author.
Some very impolite things were said about this house in terms of its structure and how it was able to be, how people were able to interact with this. Who were some of the famous people who spent time?
Authors, Edith Wharton, you were referring to not a great experience that the author Henry James had at the house, although he had very good things to say about what he referred to as the good George Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. So he was very fond of George and Edith, but had a bit of called his room an icebox when he was there. Edith Wharton, the remarkable Edith Wharton, the first woman to ever win the Pulitzer Prize. Edith Wharton stayed there. John Muir, the naturalist, passed through while George and Edith were on their honeymoon. President Roosevelt, President Roosevelt's daughter Alice, President McKinley stopped by unexpectedly. It went on and on and on. And it was, you know, some of this was because these were people in their social circles, and others, in the case of McKinley, for example, it was if you were a big shot and you were coming to town, you were hoping to get to walk through the house.
It wasn't just about the house. We only have a couple minutes left here, but George envisioned a working estate. And he was ahead of his time in installing a lot of those features in the house, rare for the day. Today, Biltmore does a lot with solar power, I'm told. The estate has a lot of biofuel projects. It is a self-sustaining operation now. What do you believe he'd think about the operation and what it has done in terms of both of conservation and building the the economy of Asheville?
I think both he and Edith would be thrilled and probably surprised at how successful the estate has been, not merely as a place for people to visit, But because of all those things you've mentioned, there still is so much land surrounding it. All the solar power innovations they've done. I believe they grow canola and do biofuel work there. So I think George and Edith would be delighted and proud at.
I'll stop you there. Theirs is a fascinating story. We have not even touched the surface of it, but that's why the book exists. The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home, Biltmore House. Denise Kiernan, our guest and the author of that book. Always fun to talk to you. Thanks for joining us for the hour.
Thanks, Mike.